Welcome to The Lobbying Show, a podcast about the people in government relations, how they got into it, what their jobs entail, what works, and what doesn't. I'm your host, Jim O'Brien. So today we're going to be sitting down with Bradley Tusk. Bradley Tusk is one of the most innovative and groundbreaking people probably in the government affairs campaign world. He has worked for such people as Senator Schumer, Mayor Bloomberg, actually ran the state of Illinois. The governor of Illinois hires his lieutenant governor, who acts as basically the chief of staff for the entire state of Illinois. And Bradley has created a firm now in New York that advises such companies as Uber and other startup type companies. And he has really reinvented the entire industry. To say he is a trailblazer would be an understatement. He also has a new book out called The Fixer. And it's a great book. He does not pull any punches. It was a great read. We are very excited to sit down and interview him today. I don't really know what to expect. He's very smart. He has had a lot of success. If this is a tough business, New York is clearly the toughest place to do it. And he has worked for the toughest people in New York. So this is going to be, I have to say, I'm a little bit, I wouldn't say nervous, but a little bit like I don't know what to expect. I have a feeling he's going to blow in here, shut the door, and we're going to do the interview all business, and then he's going to blow out of here and go to his next meeting. But we are really looking forward to sitting down with him, and I hope you enjoy it. This is our first author, so this is groundbreaking. Actually, it's not, but, you know, it sounds good, so what the heck. Anyways, I hope you enjoy the interview today. We are sitting in the conference room waiting for Brad to come in. So there you have it. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, sure. It was fun. A lot of what we do are ideas that I actually love to see people who are focused on lobbying better understand and kind of advance towards, right? I mean, I feel like you've got a business that in many ways has not evolved in the way the world has evolved.
Why is that?
Because I think most.
I mean, you're like you are reinventing the business. I mean, now look out at your floor, and it looks. We're in a building where there's a analyst firm up above us. It's like a Bloomberg operation. Yeah. That's what your firm looks like.
I mean, look. I think it's because by definition, but we hire lobbyists all over the country all the time. So it's not like we don't work lobbyists because we do constantly.
Right.
And sometimes we register as lobbyists if we need to.
Right.
The days where you can make a phone call and take care of something are basically over, right? And in my view, when you're going to make that call, you should assume the FBI is on the other end of that call too, right? So like the value proposition of a lobbyist as, hey, I can cover this whole thing on the inside because I went to college with a state senator, or I was at this one's wedding, or I took him to a strip club last week. Like that world doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And so lobbying should be, in our view, one tool of a much broader campaign that says we've got to get from point A to point B. There's an inside game, there's an outside game, and we need all these pieces working together in concert to get there, right? I think many lobbyists, because they are afraid that they will be made redundant or unnecessary,
absolutely
fight that,
yes,
which is silly because in reality, you need someone who trolls the halls of a state house, a city hall, whatever it is. Like that's. You do need it, right?
It's part of the team.
Right. The question is they just need to understand that the world has evolved and here's how they fit into it. And the really good lobbyists do. Right? I mean, we have lobbyists probably on the payroll for one portfolio company or another in 25, 30 cities or states at any given time.
Right.
They get it, right? But a lot of them, you know, also I would say, you know, I tend to be fairly blunt, which means this may or may not be a welcome podcast.
Yes, you do. But, your book was quite refreshing.
Yes.
You did not. Sure. It was not what I expected. You did not pull any punches.
No, some people are upset, but so be it.
It's probably going to help with sales. But
Probably.
I mean,
I think also, I tell this to clients all the time. For most lobbyists that we interact with, their true client is the elected official that they're trying to influence and not the person paying the bills. Because at the end of the day, they've, no matter how close with them they are, they have a limited amount of political capital and they need to juggle and spread it out thinly enough just so they don't get fired by a client, but they don't use so much of it that they don't have a left from another client either, right? And right. As a result, you know, frequently, like when a lobbyist says, oh no, you shouldn't do that, it's too negative, it's too controversial, they're worried about their relationship with the elected official. They're not worried about the client winning or losing. And whenever we have a lobbyist like that, we fire them immediately, right? We want lobbyists who understand that, like, the goal here is to achieve a specific business objective, and if you sell yourself as having this political capital, then you're going to have to use political capital. And if you succeed, we're a great source of repeat business. We could have 10 campaigns going in Texas at any given time. If someone's good, we'll send them all to them, right?
Yeah.
So we become people's biggest clients often, but only if they're willing to basically say, I'm going to do whatever it takes in each individual campaign.
To win.
And most lobbyists don't do that, in my experience.
And so have you started to see the industry change or respond to your demands?
A little bit. I mean, look. People certainly like our... Are we recording?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Yes. Yeah, we're just chatting.
Right? Oh, no.
Okay. I mean, I think that there are at least the lobbyists that we have worked well with all over the country, and because our work tends to encompass so many markets, we've got a pretty good sense of people. I mean, I would argue the kind of campaigns we run are pretty fun, right? Because it's usually on behalf of
sports betting.
Yes, cannabis, cryptocurrency, interesting topics, upstarts are trying to change industries. You know, it's not, no one hires us to preserve the status quo, right? We're not interested.
You're breaking through walls.
Right. So by definition, those are usually pretty fun campaigns. So I think people like them. Two, they're really coordinated, right? So every day, 7 a.m., we put out an email that goes to the client, but everyone on the team gets it saying...
So you still do that?
Yeah, I don't send it anymore. The team does. Right. But yeah, we still send it every single day.
Every day, your clients get an email at 7 in the morning.
It says, here's what's going on.
Every jurisdiction, yesterday, every issue. What's going on today?
Here's what's happening in Texas. Here's what's happening in Utah. Here's what's happening in Indiana. Here's what's happening on earned media, on social media, on paid media, on polling, on lobbying. It's a lot of work, but what it does do is it creates a coordinated campaign. And I think the lobbyists, that at least the ones that we work with who like it, feel like, okay... this is cool because there's a bigger purpose here. This is not just like me getting a staffer to come out for drinks three times and begging them to do whatever they need them to do.
Right.
I have a role to play here, but it's part of a broader picture. I think some lobbyists really like that, and they understand that it ultimately can be pretty fun and successful and lucrative too. Right? I mean, our goal is, you know, we don't take commissions, we don't take referral fees, we don't mark anything up. So when our clients hire lobbyists, our clients are paying for the lobbyists. We would rather pay more money, and we'd rather pay 15, 20 grand a month and get lobbyists who are really good.
You want to get the job done.
Yeah, than paying $500 or $7,500 a month and getting someone shitty. So, like, our goal is for the lobbyists who we work with to make a lot of money. And by the way, there are lobbyists who, in some states you're allowed to take equity, in some states you're not.
Correct.
There are lobbyists that we've gotten people equity in companies like Uber or Bird or whatever it is.
Right.
And people have made a lot of money, right? And that's great, you know, from our perspective. And then we'll also, the last part is, we'll lean on those people for sort of two things. You know, while we don't take markups or commissions or referral fees, we will, A, from my foundation, Tusk Montgomery Philanthropies, we do hire lobbyists for the campaigns we run around both school breakfast and mobile voting. But in terms of getting intel, getting introductions, hey, we want to meet the Secretary of State in Colorado, whatever it is, we might call some lobbyists and say, okay, hey, we need a favor, you know, and we've sent you three clients in the last 12 months and you've made, you know, $400,000 and we haven't taken a penny of that, you're going to have to do this for us. So we'll do that. Or sometimes just intel, like on a trend, like, hey, what do you think's happening with blockchain and from a legislative regulatory front in your state,
right?
And then often that then leads to them getting hired. You know, we try to have a network of lobbyists that we really like working with. And it's pretty bipartisan, right? I'm an independent. I really dislike both political parties pretty intensely. And so it just depends on what we need. There are blue states where we need blue lobbyists, there are blue states where we need red lobbyists, and vice versa.
Right.
We're very agnostic. We're not partisan at all.
So there were four topics that I was going to touch on today. Your political past experience, and different people you've worked for, Uber/startups, the firm is kind of what you're jumping into now. Yeah. And then you also touched on the future, how you see the future. So the firm, where, do you remember how you got the idea that you could kind of remake
this industry? Yeah, I mean, so I...
Unless I'm wrong, I think you're the first to do what you're doing.
Yeah, no one's ever accused me of having a small ego, so I'm not going to disagree with you. But,
well, you know, given the fact you went to UPenn, University of Chicago,
the journal review of the book last week, they started whacking me around for that pretty good. I deserved it. But I would say this. So when I started my first business, Tusk Strategies, what I tried to ask myself is, what value proposition do I have to the marketplace that's somewhat unique? And what do I enjoy doing, right? And the way I saw it is...
And this is post, just after...
This is right after the Bloomberg campaign. Yeah, so this is like late 2009, I'm figuring it out.
Okay.
Launched it, I think, January 2nd, 2010.
Yeah.
And then the things that that made sense to me were, one, I had experience in a lot of different types of jurisdictions. I had been deputy governor of Illinois. I worked for Schumer on the Hill. I did a lot in New York. When I was at Lehman, I ran from state capital 5 days a week for a year and a half. So I really understood... kind of the playing field broadly.
Yep.
That's one. Two, I like taking a concept and say, okay, this is hard. We've got to get from point A to point B. How are we going to do it? I'm going to put together all of the different pieces. There may be some of those pieces that I do myself. A lot of those pieces I'm going to outsource to other people. But my job is to win. And so, you know, my pitch effectively became to clients, if you have a lot at stake and a lot of money, you should hire us, right? If it's not that big of a deal to you, there's no reason to add on all of our fees and process onto it. But if you're talking about $1 billion outcome here, you know, we materially improve your chances of winning, right?
I will bring what I did at the Bloomberg campaign, I will bring to your issue around the country.
Every day, 5 a.m., I sent Mike an email saying, here's who's endorsing you today, here's what the polls say, here's what was the door knocks last night, everything else. And it, you know, worked really well for a few reasons. One, I was insanely neurotic, so it kind of helped me calm down. Two, we had a newborn, so I was up anyway. But three, Mike doesn't really like politics, right? Mike likes governing, and Mike was still mayor when we were running the campaign. And so I think in his mind, I was like, okay, I can wake up. This thing that I know is important because I want to keep being mayor is being handled.
Yep.
I'll deal with Bradley or the campaign if I need to, but if I don't need to, I'll just go out my day being mayor.
Yep.
So it worked really well for him,
yep.
Which was how I got the idea of the email, and we've just never stopped doing it. And clients, you know, clients love it for three reasons. One, you wake up, and there we are. You're paying us a lot of money, but...
You know it's going to be there.
Yeah, and it's like, we're working hard, right?
Yep.
We're getting up before you, and we're already at work. That's one. Two, it sets an agenda that everyone can work off of for that day. So you don't necessarily have to have lots of, like, here's our weekly call or our monthly meeting. We can do that too, but in reality, we shouldn't even need that because we're just interacting on a much more fluid, constant basis.
Right.
And three, for me as a manager tool, because I'm CC'd on all of them, even though we have now at any given time between the consulting business, the venture capital fund, the equity business, probably 40-odd clients or projects we're working on, every morning I get a report on all 40 of them, so I know what's going on myself. So I can say, all right, this looks like this is going to be a problem. How come you guys haven't thought about this? Or, hey, have we tried this idea? And whatever it is, and I can jump in. And our general counsel CC'd on them too, so if there's any even risk of a legal issue anywhere, she's seeing it on the front end. So it's a pretty good strategy. Given that I've never hidden the fact that we do this, I've been amazed that no one has copied this strategy. Now, it's a lot of work. People getting up at 5 in the morning to draft these emails. So like, I get it, and it's hard to work for me in some ways because you have to do this, right? Now, I don't care what time you show up at the office. If you want to go to the gym after that and show up at 9:30, like, that's fine with me. But I've been kind of amazed that no one has stolen the idea.
So it goes out at 5 or 7 a.m.?
It goes out at 7, but they're working, you know, it's a meaningful document. So they're waking up.
At 5 to send it out at 7.
Yeah, or maybe some people are writing it late the night before or whatever. Right. They've never got their own strategy.
But they got to wake up in the morning, check the news, see if anything's changed.
Yeah, there are clips that are relevant. Yeah, everything else.
Just to summarize, so when you are working on a campaign and you think about the different buckets, you think about polling, you think about grassroots, you think about media, you think about lobbying. Mm-hmm. Am I missing any?
Oppo, for sure.
Oppo,
I mean, and really maybe the best way to break it up is inside game and outside game, right?
Oh,
so
okay.
Inside game would be lobbying for sure.
Yep.
I actually see polling as an inside game tactic in many ways because what you're really trying to do is convince lawmakers or staffers that, hey, this is where the voters are, or these are where the influencers that you need are, and therefore you should do what we want. So sometimes it's a media persuasion document too,
right.
But oftentimes it's really more about the inside game. So I see that. And then on the outside game, obviously comms is, you know, becomes more and more paramount every single day.
Yep.
Social, so, you know, Twitter
it's and part of that. Else. Yep.
It's part of that, but it's own world. We have people here who just do digital pieces of campaigns that are, it's part of our comms team, but it's a separate job description here because there's so much going on.
Yep.
Grassroots, so, you know, the way we won all these fights for Uber is we mobilized our customers all over the country to fight against taxi and against their lobbyists and against their campaign contributions.
Yep.
And that proved really effective. And then opposition research, you know, and part of, again, what we're willing to do, and you noted this in the candor of the book, is we just call them like we see them, right? And we do not make our money based on people liking us. So
like Elon Musk in...
Correct, yeah, Elon Musk. Get after that chapter. But, you know, ultimately, if we have to take a whack at somebody, whether it's a politician, an entrenched interest, a union leader, a trade group, anyone else, if that's the best strategy to get from point A to point B for this campaign, we're going to do that. And if that person then hates me or hates my company, so be it. That's the choice I made when I took your money or your equity or invested in your startup. And that's the choice that I made, right? And I have to get business based on our ability to do things that very few other people can do, not like, hey, I'm buddies with this guy and my wife, you know, plays canasta with this one. I don't know.
So I can't be too tough.
Yeah, and I think that scares people off. And so we're willing to do what it takes. Now, what I have learned over time is if you're actually totally candid and transparent and you have money and power and influence and success, it actually works the other way, which is people actually get afraid to screw with you as opposed to saying, oh, I'm offended. Because like, the reality is every politician by definition lives for attention, right? You know, 99.9% of them, or in my view, are desperately self-loathing, insecure people who can't live without the validation of running for and holding office. And so the whole point is governing is just the means to the end. The end is validation. The end is attention. Now, Mike Bloomberg was a clear exception in my career, but he was the only exception that I really saw.
He was the only one you've seen?
Yeah. I mean, look, I work with people who were...
You work with Chuck Schumer and Mike Bloomberg, two polar opposites when it comes to the media.
Well, put it this way. So, take Chuck Schumer and Rob LaGoyva. Chuck's always deputy governor of Illinois. Rob was corrupt, is in jail, and belongs in jail. Chuck is honest and smart and hardworking. But at the end of the day, Chuck is solely driven by his insecurity and his ego, his need for attention, right? 100%. That's what drives him.
And you were his media.
Yeah, person. I know this because I ran his press. Yeah,
I mean,
it's not an outside observation.
This is a tough business, and you are in the toughest market, working for what has to be one of the most aggressive.
Yeah, I mean, but I learned when people even now come to me and say, "Hey, should I go work in Schumer's office?" My answer is always, if you can stomach 2 years that you'll hate, but you will learn an incredible amount. Absolutely.
Has he mellowed at all since he's gotten in leadership? I mean, now that he doesn't need to fight for media?
Because I'm fairly independent and candid, we don't talk much. But I think, in some ways, let me re-ask the question. I would say the arbiter of whether he succeeds as leader, minority leader, at some point he'll become majority leader.
Yeah.
I don't think this cycle, but at some point. Is can he temper those instincts, right? Because to be a really good leader, you have to give other people credit.
Oh, good
you have
point.
To make them feel good. You have to make them feel included.
Right.
And if you can't temper your own ego and your own need for attention at all times, eventually they're all going to rebel against you. So to me, like, he has the savvy, the smarts, the experience, the work ethic, the hustle, all the other things you would need to be a really good leader. I mean, he could be LBJ-like. But his fatal flaw is he willing to be able to give up some attention for the greater good? Now, intellectually, I'm sure he understands he needs to do that. I don't know if psychologically and emotionally he can. And that's the real question here.
Right. Your business, you touched on the venture capital piece and the equity piece, I think.
So
can you explain the difference?
Sure. So, stop me when this gets boring. But
no.
Tusk Holdings is the parent company that I own, and it has a bunch of things underneath it. So Tusk Ventures Partners is a traditional venture capital fund, 2-in-20 model. We raise money from outside investors. We invest in startups. And the way we get access to really good startups like Bird or Circle or Coinbase or Lemonade and so on is simply because we won't take on their political problem unless we have the ability to invest. We may not choose to invest, But if I don't have the right to invest, I'm not even having a conversation.
Interesting.
So, and what we found is, you know, startups at the beginning kind of begrudgingly said, okay, but now there's something I would argue of a badge of a signaling effect where people say, okay, if they're investors, I clearly take this stuff seriously.
Yes.
So it's a signaling effect of other venture capital funds like, oh, okay, these guys are on board. That's mitigating the regulatory risk around this particular investment. Yep. I'm more likely to invest. Took a couple of years to get to that point, but I think we're at that point now. So we've raised and deployed most of our first fund. We're in the middle of now raising our second fund.
How big was your first
fund? First fund was $37 million. Fund two will be between $70 and $100
million. Okay.
Returns have been pretty great. It's a lot easier to raise a fund when you have a track record
than
when you don't. And the first time around, it was people were like, oh, I want something different. And you're like, yeah, well, here's how I'm going to get these deals because of politics. Everyone said, that's way too different. But now they kind of get it.
Well, you have, you have access to these startups that is unique. I mean, it's very different than other venture capital.
Look, we're the only ones, for better or worse, who do what we do.
And right.
Maybe at the end of the day, I'll prove to be the idiot and everyone else will prove to be right. But just based on the returns we've had so far, based on the money we've made from Uber and other startups, this seems to work. So, you know, I ask myself all the time, okay, who from politics is going to come up and challenge me and do what I do, right? So there's, on one hand, the answer is there's always going to be somebody. On
right.
the other hand, though, here's where I tell myself to sleep better at night. In order to do what we do, a bunch of weird shit has to fall into place, right? So one is you have to have a really high risk tolerance, right? So in our equity for services business, where we're taking equity from companies for our work instead of cash,
okay.
that costs me $4 or $5 million a year out of my pocket in all the personnel costs that I have to do all of the work.
Okay.
That it should yield 15, 20 million a year back, but it might not for 5 or 7 years, and it might be zero. And you know, you have to be willing to really put a lot on the line. So that's one. Two, you have to have the profits in the first place to have the money to invest, right? You know, when I started my business, it was harder because our fees are really high. At the time, it was $25,000 a month. Our average fee now is more like $75,000 a month. But it does mean that you can generate a significant amount of revenue. And if you have the risk tolerance, then reinvest those profits into the venture stuff. That's the opportunity. But you have to both be making that money in the first place and have the willingness to risk it. And then, you know, we got really lucky in that I had these twin credentials of Bloomberg and Uber.
Yes.
So kind of the greatest politician ever who came out of tech and the most successful startup ever, at least one of them. That had a story around what it did politically that was really, really unique and just unrivaled. I'm lucky to have both of those credentials at hand and have, by the way, still ongoing relationships with Mike and with Travis that I can call on and do call on. So that really helps. And then also, in some ways, I've had a weird career, which has probably made it harder at times, but easier in the sense that most people either do one of two things. They're a pollster, they make ads, they do Oppo, and they do it for lots of races or lots of companies all over the country, but they do one thing. Or they're more like us and they'll run a campaign, but they're focused on Albany, Sacramento, Tallahassee, DC, whatever it is, but they tend to be focused on one market because that's where their relationships and expertise has been. They worked in politics and government in that market. That's where they grew up and that's what they know. Because we're able to do this, you know, that type of running campaigns everywhere, and we can do 20 cities at one time, that makes us a somewhat unique player in the marketplace. There are not many other people who have that. So when you add all of those things together, at some point, will someone pop up with a fund like mine? Absolutely. But I do think that the underlying metrics are hard to get to, and I only got there kind of by, you know, iteration, right? It wasn't like in fifth grade said I'm gonna be a venture capitalist. It's just a thing happened, the next thing happened, and it started to become clear to me that there was a real opportunity. I pursued it, and it's still a ton of work, right? But it's fun.
And so you could have a client that touches all three businesses.
Potentially. I mean, there are people who we will invest in, we'll then run a campaign for them, and we'll take equity, or we'll take cash, or we'll take a mix.
Because you could do a combination.
Yeah.
Which is what you did for Uber.
Yeah, exactly. So it can be any different. I mean, we find that if we want to get a deal done, we can usually get a deal done, requires some creativity. But also, by definition, when I said earlier, it makes sense to hire us if you have a lot of stake and a lot of money. That's still true now for startups, too. Now, maybe we don't need cash, we're just taking equity, but you better have to have us, right? So like, you take Lemonade, which is just one of the kind of the hottest insurance tech startups. Lemonade couldn't, no matter how good they were, until they were licensed to sell insurance in the States, they couldn't sell insurance, right? So they had to have us Daniel Schreiber, who's the CEO of Lemonade, said, this is either going to be the best deal or the worst deal I've ever done, because our fees are really high, we took it in equity, we invested capital, and I think he'll tell you, or he has said, it's the best deal because it worked, right? We got the prices all over the country, and their growth is exponential.
Right.
But we only make sense in those situations. I found now that we really don't need anyone's business, anyone's money, kind of anyone's anything. I've become much more picky and aggressive in saying to potential clients, how important is this to you? Because even if you can't afford us, if this isn't a top priority for you, I don't want to do it, right? Like, we work too hard and we get too into what we're doing to just be kind of a nice to have.
Now, in your book, you talk about how it's important for you to pick the right clients. Is that because you only have so much bandwidth?
Yeah, so like on the startup side, you know, typically we can do, in terms of equity-based deals, about a dozen at a time.
Okay.
Right? Because even in the $4 or $5 million a year that I allocate to that piece of the business, it still basically has enough capacity to do around that, right?
Okay.
So we try to pick carefully, and we also put 60-day outs in the contract. So if we start working with a startup and we realize we totally got this wrong, these people are a disaster, and we try to help them and they can't get help, we get out, right? Because at the end of the day, if the equity's actually worth anything, then there's no point.
It's not worth spending 2 years working on this campaign.
Correct, right. So you know, and then on the cash side, I mean, in theory, we could do it, we get resumes every day, so it's not like we couldn't just keep hiring and keep doing more and more. But when you're charging $7,500, $125,000, $150,000 a month, there's a limited universe of clients, right? If you're charging $15,000 a month, you can get clients all day long, and that's a perfectly fine business model. It's just not my business model.
Right.
And then also, it's how I want to spend my time, right? So I've got, you know, a bunch of things going on. I care a lot about my fund and the work we're trying to do at the intersection of tech and politics, and I think we're the only ones doing it, so it's kind of unique. I have Tusk Montgomery Philanthropies now, and there's, you know, hopefully we'll talk about mobile voting, but there are these big initiatives that I fund and spend time on. And then I really like all of the writing. It was really fun to write that book. It's fun to write columns. It's fun to host a podcast too.
Yep.
So I want to keep doing that in different forms. And so for me to have time to do all of these different things, to a certain extent, you know, we can't have an unlimited number of clients. Because even if I'm not running the campaigns day to day anymore, I'm still responsible for them.
So starting going to politics, StarQuest.
Yeah.
What is your favorite memory or funniest story that you can think of with StarQuest?
So StarQuest is a guy named Henry Stern. Had you heard of him before the book?
I had heard of him. I did not know that you had worked for him.
Yeah, so Henry is a sort of crazy legendary figure in Europe politics who's kind of, he's 85, never thought that. So he's kind of fading from memory a little bit. But he was the first commissioner under Koch and then again under Giuliani. I worked for him when he was commissioner under Giuliani and I came out of college. And he's a brilliant man. Like, I think the youngest graduate ever of Harvard Law School. You know, his IQ is so high that there's that straddling line between kind of genius and crazy, and he was always right at that. And I think he'd be the first to tell you that, right? Right at that precipice. But the thing about him that was so unique, two things. One is he loved the city's parks in a way that no one else did. Like, if we were in a park and there was trash on the ground, he went and picked it up. If, you know, we wanted to draw attention for a local ribbon cutting and he needed to lead a flock of sheep across the Sheep Meadow Central Park and dress up like a shepherd, he did it, right? When we needed money to pay for the new Parks Department website, we got Earthlink to be our sponsor. We dressed him up in a silver sequin outfit and built a 40 by 40 foot spider web in Central Park and launched him in Launching Over the Web, which was probably 20 years ago. And he did it, right? He was willing to do whatever it took to try to really help his agency endow the parks. So that was incredibly memorable and just a great learning experience. And the other thing is, he really built this sense of, our starting salary was $22,000 a year, and yet he had all these kids out of all these great schools working 80 hours a week. We probably legally had to work 35. We were doubling that every week consistently and loving every minute of it because we felt that there was a sense of mission, right? Which is these parks, like New Yorkers, it's pretty simple, which is, if you're a New York City resident like I am, all 8.6 million New Yorkers at some point in the course of the year interact with a park at least once, right? So if parks are clean and safe, your quality of life is higher, and if they're dirty and dangerous, your quality of life is low. It's that kind of cut and simple. So the work was really important because, yeah, we weren't solving poverty or crime. I understand there are things that are considered more noble or higher, you know, higher calling, but to us it was important because we knew that we were having a real impact on people's lives. And he gave us incredible freedom to really run lots of parts of the agency in ways that have never been done before. And you get the sense of like, hey, you can accomplish incredible things in government. But I also learned that if you work in a place where people are really smart and really motivated and has a sense of mission, they can get anything done, which translated perfectly to startup world also. So one of the reasons that we were able to make this transition from being a political consulting firm to a venture capital fund is in a lot of ways a political startup and a political campaign or a really great government office are actually very similar, maybe not the kind of work they're doing, but in spirit, in mission, in energy. And so the transfer of skills is a lot easier than you would think.
I think my favorite story in the book is the Ed Rendell story.
Sure, you want me to tell it?
Yeah, that is just a, and it's a great, great lesson. And I have to admit, I don't think I would have gone up to him.
I'm not sure now I would either. But so, summer of 1992, I'm 18 years old. I just finished my freshman year at Penn, so I'd come from Philly, but I was back in New York. I was working at a beach club as a cabana boy. If anyone remembers that movie, The Flamingo Kid, that was my job without the MILFs and the high-stakes chintz games. And I'm a first-generation American. We didn't really have that much money. We didn't know anybody. But my dad had a friend named Brian O'Dwyer, who was a lawyer for the Carpenters Union. Brian's a really nice guy. Brian knew that I liked politics. And he called me and said, hey, do you want a carpenter's pass to the convention? Great, you know, awesome.
A classic way that people get into the convention.
So, yep. Right. So,
yeah, classic.
If you look at the newspaper, the convention says, it says noon to midnight. Now, in reality, it's like 8 p.m. to 11 p.m., right? But I'm 18, I don't know anything, right?
It says noon.
I get there at noon, right? So I'm walking around Madison Square Garden, and because I have this carpenter's pants, I can go anywhere, because I'm supposed to be, like, fixing stuff, right?
Right.
And, you know, after, like, an hour, I kind of realize, like, okay, I'm here a little early. It's like two guys running for state rep in Montana speaking, and, like, no one else in the garden. But I look up, and Ed Rendell, at the time was the mayor of Philadelphia, was sitting in the audience by himself. And I don't know why he was, and I've asked him since, and he doesn't really know why he was either, but he was. And I sat there kind of debating with myself, like, can I go talk to him? First, I'm like, no, he's very important, you don't want to bother him. But I'm like, you know what? He's the mayor of Philly. I go to college in Philly. He's a Jewish guy from New York, so am I. Let me go say hi. Now, knowing Rendell, he's probably just talking to the empty chair next to him. Right? So, like, he was thrilled to have someone come over. And I'm sure I went over and told him how great he was. So it wasn't like, it was not exactly a hard conversation for him. So we're chatting for, say, 10 minutes. And he said, when you get back to school, are you busy? And the honest answer was, no, not really. So do you want an internship? So that'd be great.
And you're at UPenn.
I'm at Penn. Yep. So he said, okay, send me a letter. We'll set it up. So I go home. I write a letter. And every day, I'm opening the mailbox. I'm waiting for the reply. And what I know now but didn't know then is that correspondence is the black hole of government, right? Everything comes in. Nothing goes out. And so, of course, I'm not going to get a reply, but I understand that. So I get back to school. This is 1992, so it's a decade before 9/11, so security is not where it is today.
Right.
And I just have this ridiculous thought of, like, well, I'll just go see him. So I went to City Hall, got on the subway, went to City Hall, got to, like, his outer office and said, is the mayor here? Which, is a crazy question, right? And having now walked past that outer office on the way to my office when I, you know, was in the governor's office or mayor's office or senator's office or whatever right. It is, the people usually who are there are either A, crazy, right? Or B, they're protesting something. I didn't have petitions, and I wasn't crazy. I was just like super naive kid who showed up. And so we had these like old nice ladies from South Philly who were working the desk, and they said, well, he's a little busy. And I said, could I leave a note? They said, sure. So I leave a note, get back on the step to the dorms of Penn. About halfway in the ride, I'm like, oh, you fucking idiot. Like, you can't just go see the mayor. Like, he's never going to call you. Like, forget it. And I kind of written it off. I get in the dorm room. 10 minutes later, the phone rings. Please hold for the mayor. When are you coming to work? And I spent all college working for him.
That's incredible.
Yeah. It's I got very, very... I mean, a lot of these stories are, I got very lucky to work with people who were really passionate, really dedicated, and were willing to go out of their way for other people, like Brian O'Dwyer, Henry Stern, Ed Rendell, certainly like Mike Bloomberg.
Well, you're right. You did get lucky, but you also created your luck. I mean, you went up, you asked him, you sent a letter in, and then you followed up. I mean, you went down to the mayor's office.
Yeah.
I mean, you did get lucky, but you also kind of made it happen. So
yeah, it's funny. So right, first time I told that story publicly was on Kara Swisher.
Yeah.
I was on Kara's podcast, and I said, "Shit, now people start showing up in my office," and all of a sudden, some guy does. He's turned out Yoni Reitman. At first, we're like, oh, he's just like some pain in the ass. We'll give him an internship. He's like one of the stars of our investment team now. So I'm glad I told that story.
So we touched on, why don't we go to Senator Schumer. We've touched on working for him. How did you come about working for him?
You
know, and just what was that like?
So the working for him was kind of random. So I, at that point, had finished law school.
At University of Chicago.
University of Chicago.
And you did not take Obama's class.
I did not, which was fairly stupid in retrospect. But you know what? There was like...
Which he pointed out to you.
But the other guy like was probably like a Nobel Prize winner, right? So like, it didn't seem irrational at the time.
But tell us a great story.
Obama was a professor at Chicago when I was
taught
in school.
Taught constitutional law.
But it was a superstar professor. Everyone, I wish I had taken class simply because everyone loved it who took the class. Sure. But there's a guy, David Curry, who was like a legend of con law in America. I took his class. That seemed like the right call. It was actually a little boring. But when I then, a few years later, many years later, came back to Illinois as deputy governor, I'm sitting in the state house in Springfield, and he walks over to me and he says, "You didn't take my class." And I said, "You're absolutely right. I'm sorry." It was a very personal way of him basically saying hello. And for the time that he was there, that we overlapped, you know, he was great to work with.
Classic President Obama.
But yeah, tweaking
you.
Yeah, but in a way that it was totally endearing.
Right. So Senator Schumer.
So there was this crazy event. So when we would build a new park or a playground, we would make a big deal about it in the press because if you're a city council member and you use your discretionary budget, and this is probably a little technical at some point, but you have a certain amount of discretionary capital budget. And if you use that discretionary capital budget on a park, we wanted to make sure that you got really good press to send you positive incentives to keep doing that, right? And since we know they all live for getting attention, we worked really hard at making the ribbon cuttings and groundbreakings just great, right? Really, because it was ultimately a budget strategy, right? And a capital project
strategy. Encourage more money coming
in. Right, not just the PR strategy. So, but bathrooms are really complicated when it comes to parks because you have homeless people, bad things can happen in there, people shoot drugs. So parks are tending to
clean.
Yeah, really hard to keep clean. So parks are tending to not build bathrooms, but for some reason, East River Park, which is kind of the lower east side of Manhattan, the bathroom was included in the project. I don't know why, but it was. But that was a pretty unique thing. So we had this idea, like instead of cutting a ribbon, why don't we cut a roll of toilet paper? And we did, and it got a lot of press. And okay, Steven Rubenstein, who's kind of a PR guru in New York, heard about it, and I guess Chuck had said to him, "I'm looking for a communications director," and he said, "Well, this guy seems pretty smart." And in a way, I really didn't want the job because I didn't want to live in D.C., I didn't want to do press, and I didn't want to work in the legislative branch. And of course, by not wanting it, that made Chuck really want me to take the job, right? And so we kind of negotiated back and forth, and eventually we agreed that I would kind of be where he was going to be. So he was in New York, I was in New York, he was in D.C., I was in D.C., and did it for 2 years. It was both insane in a good way and a bad way. In a bad way in that, you know, 80-90% of what we did was kind of the opposite of that playground strategy I just mentioned. It was just attention for the sake of attention, right? So like, Chuck's famous for the Sunday press conference. So we would, you know, almost any Sunday where we didn't have something better to do, we'd send a letter to somebody complaining about something. You know, we're protesting the high price of breakfast cereal to Kellogg, you know, food company, whatever it is. But the only point of the event was the event itself,
the press,
right? And like, this is way before, you know, email was just getting going then, before all that other stuff. And so the press would, and when we do it on Sunday Park, the press would call Kellogg, and nobody would be there, and then we'd have the whole story to ourselves, right? But sometimes I noticed that the comment was, "We didn't get the letter." So I realized, I'm like, oh shit, I keep forgetting this in the letter, because it was so besides the point, like once the cameras were gone, on to the next
the
one,
point's
right?
The point's like the letter.
Right, so I had a post-it note on my computer that said, "Remember to send the letter."
Oh, that is great.
So on one hand, it was a lot of that, and that was nice. Yep. On the other hand, a year into my tenure there was 9/11. And I will say that Chuck was truly incredible in the aftermath of that. And you know, all of his good qualities really kicked in. You know, just intense work ethic, savvy negotiating for the recovery money for
New York.
And in the same way that people find politicians irksome when they're going around taking credit in normal times, in the time of crisis and disaster, they actually turns out they really like having their leaders around. So I remember at first, because Chuck wanted to be in every conceivable 9/11 related thing, thinking, oh, we're taking advantage of this terrible tragedy, this is not good. And then kind of seeing how people were responding to him and saying, you know what, it's helping them.
They like, needed to see they their needed leaders. To see,
yeah, yes. He was really good with them. It's like, this is actually important. And so in some ways, all of Chuck's both preferences and skills fit in perfectly. And so I felt like for, you know, at least 3 or 4 months, and we just worked around the clock on it, it was really meaningful because we were able to try to help the city get through this and get past this. And we did. Now, once eventually things are returning to normal, they return to normal in Chuck World too. And Mike had wanted to become mayor, so friends of mine had helped run the campaign. And so they said, hey, why don't you come to City Hall? So I made a 2-year commitment to Chuck. It's like being in the military or whatever. And when 2 years was over, next day I showed up at City Hall and started working for Mike.
And so during the Senator Schumer, you did overlap then with Senator Clinton too.
Yeah, I did, and it was not easy in the sense that, so Chuck, you know, is a hard worker, and Chuck really needs attention at all times, and. You know, he was a state assembly member, then he was a congressman for 18 years, then he beat them out on a big upset, took the Senate seat, and Moynihan had just retired, so Chuck was finally the senior senator from New York.
Senator from New York. What? Can't get much higher than
that. That's it, right? That's amazing.
Yep.
And then this person, who's the most famous woman in the world, who had, like, really never been to New York except, like, a fundraiser, buys a house in Westchester, runs for U.S. Senate, and wins. And now it's like she's the junior senator, but like I think it's in the book, she can get more attention by taking the wrong elevator than we get with for 50 press conferences combined, right?
Right.
And it drove him batshit crazy, you know? and
you're the comms guy.
Yeah, so a lot of my time was spent, you know, just screwing with her in every way we possibly could, you know, mainly just to make him feel better about his relative positioning to her. She didn't really screw with us. We were just a nuisance that like was barely even worth noticing. Then when 9/11 happened, they actually did work incredibly well together. But then we had this challenge where the Times decided for their magazine cover story one week, they would profile Chuck and Hillary's relationship. And we were at this weird inflection point where it was like, well, the story could be about how these two people are really working hard to help New York recover, which was totally true.
Yep.
How these two politicians were totally petty and screwing with each other and wasting all of this time on nonsense. Also totally true. And there were two competing narratives, right? And Frank Bruni, who's now an op-ed columnist at the time, was working for the magazine and writing the story. And Frank's really smart, right? So it's not, he can't really pull the wool over Frank's eyes, but we tried. And so we both offices worked really hard to try to kind of coordinate a campaign to make sure that we look like we were working in unison and not fighting and sniping at each other. And we got really lucky as that was happening, Trent Lott was trying to stop New York from getting the money from 9/11. And so instead of the opponent being each other, we had a common enemy. And if you're the New York Times, like, you already hate Trent Lott, right? So it's like super easy to make him the villain. So we kind of flipped the narrative. It's all about Chuck and Hillary fighting to stop Lott from hurting New York, which worked, and they did, in part because President Bush was on Chuck and Hillary's side, so ultimately had what he needed.
Right. Because he had already made the
commitment. He had already made the commitment to Chuck and Hillary. And, you know, I happened to be at Ground Zero on September 12th with Chuck and President Bush and everyone else. You can't have been there at that moment and not said, I'm going to do whatever I have to do.
Right. There was no way New York was not getting their money.
Right. Though Mitch Daniels at the time was ahead of OMB, and Trent Lott certainly tried to stop it. Yeah. And so luckily, Frank kind of wrote the story around their efforts to overcome Lott, and that worked out really well.
Well, you touch on controlling the narrative and how important that is.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, at the end of the day, even if your only goal is to achieve some sort of substantive outcome, pass a bill, block a bill, pass a regulation, whatever it is, the people with whom you're trying to influence are solely driven by attention, by media, by validation, by ego. And so if you want them to behave in certain ways, you have to be able to shape a narrative that either makes it in their interest to cooperate with you or very much not in their interest to not cooperate with you, right? So like if you think about Uber as the perfect example here, the taxi lobby was sort of biggest campaign contributors in the country, all over the U.S., right? Yep. And they never did anything to really improve their product or their service, but they were very good about writing checks constantly.
Yep.
And it worked until it didn't, right? So when we came along at Uber and started disrupting taxi, at first they would just say, just kind of lean on the politicians they'd written checks to, saying, you got to make the taxi regulator shut these guys down. And if we just tried to fight it, you know, with lobbyists on the inside game, we would have gotten killed, right? Because they had...
You couldn't compete.
No.
They got 50 years and all that money.
Yeah, all the money, all this stuff, right? So we said, okay, we're going to have to go into the market with or without permission, start building some market share, getting customers on our side, and then unleashing them to fight against the lobbyists and fight against the money.
So just to have you pause there for a second, that was, you know, what you're saying there is you decided, you made a major decision that you were not going to ask for permission. You were going to seek forgiveness after.
Yeah.
And so you rolled out Uber in these various cities. And so by the time they reacted, and you talk about this in your book, which is really a must read for anyone either in or near this business. It was really a great book.
I'm glad you liked it.
And so that's what you're talking about now,
yeah.
That by the time City Hall got engaged and you were fighting them,
right,
you had thousands
tens of thousands of users.
Over time, it became millions collectively.
In New York City alone and in Washington.
Nationally millions, but there were campaigns like in New York with hundreds of thousands, right? Huge numbers. And so if you're a typical city council member, your normal instinct is just to do what your donor wants, which is taxi.
Right.
But all of a sudden, let's say you can win a New York City Council race with 12,000 votes in the primary. We have twice as many people emailing you and tweeting at you who, like, you've never heard of before, but they live in the district, right? And we're able to geolocate everything. You just think, holy shit, I don't want to, like, have a real problem with voters over this thing. And so your incentives change and your actions change.
And you touch on this in the book. In a typical, which everyone who works in this business knows, in a typical campaign, if you can get a dozen people, 50 people, to send real people, to send an email or make a phone call, that is off the charts.
Yeah.
I mean, a council person to get an email from 50 people is going to change the dialogue.
Yeah.
No question about it.
For sure.
You have them getting thousands. Tell them the Washington, D.C. story.
Yeah, so...
which is just incredible. I mean, this is just... I had to read it twice.
So this was summer of 2012, and the D.C. Taxi Commissioner was named Ron Linton, who I was convinced was on a take, and it turns out he wasn't. But he was so in love with taxi that it was his life's mission to stop Uber at all costs. So he worked with the city council, a council named Mary Che at the time, to come up with like a series of rules and regulations that effectively outlawed Uber, right? You can't use an iPhone to determine distance. Everything has to be done on paper. You can't have email receipts. Like, all this ridiculous shit. And it would have just rolled right through because taxi in D.C. doles out cash just like they do in every other market.
So if you had gone the old model, when you had a couple of lobbyists on the ground, they would have gotten steamrolled.
We had lobbyists.
Even if they worked hard.
Part of it, but they were not. But it was the first one that we tried, what Travis likes to call Rolling Thunder, which is, let's reach out to our own customers and see if they're willing to weigh in. And Travis had he's not a political guy, but he had his very good political instincts in some ways, and he had this instinct that it was going to work. And we crafted an email from him to all of our D.C. customers saying, this is the situation. If you like being able to use Uber, we need your help. Here are the phone numbers, email addresses, Twitter handles, everything of all of the city council members.
To oppose this bill,
yeah,
is basically going to end Uber.
And we didn't really know for sure, but what we did know, and I think probably everyone listening to this podcast has taken a taxi in D.C. at some point.
It's awful.
The worst. The worst. So Uber customers in D.C. were particularly motivated to not lose the service because it was like it changed their lives for the better. And then all of a sudden, like, no one wants to go back to the status quo. And I think in the span of a week, 50,000 people sent unique organic emails or called. And
50,000?
50.
It's incredible.
And we not only beat the bad bill, everyone, including the sponsor, voted against the
bad
bill.
That's the part that I love.
Yeah.
Even the sponsor voted
against
it.
And then we passed it. We submitted legislation that we preferred and passed unanimously. And that was ultimately how ride sharing really ended up happening in every market in the U.S. And you can't do that all the time, right? There are some products and services that people are passionate about and you can mobilize them for, and some that you can't.
Right.
But the ones that you can, it's like FanDuel is another example, around fantasy sports campaigns around the country. We're investors in a scooter company right now called Bird that's really popular, and it's working the same way with Bird. So when you can, do you use Bird?
Yes.
Yeah. The only one in Manhattan's actually right out, or New York's right over there.
We came off the elevator and it's like, look, there you go.
Yeah, feel free to take it out. We're done. just tell anyone. It'll be legal here soon. But anyway, mobilizing, utilizing those customers was the way ultimately to overcome the traditional inside game approach. And if I can take this one step further, it was that experience plus kind of what I learned in politics that kind of led me to the work we're now doing in mobile voting, which is, I reached the conclusion that if you want politicians to behave in certain ways, they are highly logical and highly rational, and they respond to the political inputs they're getting. So let's say you're a Republican congressman from Florida, and turnout in your primary is 12%, and because of gerrymandering, the primary effectively is the general election. You may think, you know what, probably not a bad idea to ban assault weapons. We probably don't want people toting AK-47s around the district. But if half of that 12% are NRA members, you're never going to do it.
And the people that are coming out in the primary, primary,
are the most motivated.
Most motivated.
Sure. Left or right.
Either
way. So, but what I realized in these Uber campaigns was, like, wow, these same people who never vote in a primary. Like, when we were to the FanDuel campaigns, like, not only did they not know who their state rep was, most of them, they didn't know what a state rep was. It was like the bros who play fantasy sports.
Right.
But they fucking love fantasy sports, right? And they were willing to advocate to save fantasy sports, and we could do it from within the app. And so what started to hit me was, all these people who don't vote, and therefore politics is controlled by the extremes, those few people who vote in primaries or move votes or money in primaries,
yes.
If they can participate on their phone, they apparently will, because they are, right? They're advocating for a gambling company, for a tech company, whatever it is.
Right.
So that led me to realize that if we can create a way people vote on their phones in elections, we could exponentially increase turnout and bring the center of influence from the extremes back into the middle, because I believe the politicians will just do whatever the logical input they're given. If 60% are people Republicans are turning out in a primary in Florida, and the NRA's vote share goes from half to 10%, then the politics flip completely, and then it makes no sense to not be for an assault weapons ban, right? So I assume that these, you know, most politicians are basically only there because they need to be there, that's how they kind of survive, and so they're going to adapt to whatever they have to adapt to. And the hardcore ideologues got thrown out. So we've been working on creating mobile voting so that people can vote in elections on their phone, and the blockchain creates now a mechanism to do it that is pretty secure. So we started off with the state of West Virginia, both in their primary and now getting the general election. It's available to members of deployed military. Their Secretary of State, a guy named Mac Warner, felt that he had been a longtime military member and was really frustrated that the people who are really putting their lives on the line to defend our right to vote, their votes never count. They get mailed in like after the election. By the time it goes from Kandahar to, you know, Charleston, West Virginia, like it's like, you know, the election's long over at the time, right?
Right.
So Mac was looking for a way to enable service people to vote more efficiently. I'm looking for a way for people to vote on their phones, and we came together on a pilot program that he ran. I funded the state's costs. We have to avoid all the RFP processes because it was all funded philanthropically by my foundation. And we made this available to deploy military from 2 counties in West Virginia in the primaries, 24 counties in the general. We're talking to a bunch of states right now for next year. The New Yorker ran a piece yesterday on this and identified that Colorado was likely the next state. I had been holding it back, but since the New Yorker said it, I guess I'll say it too.
Okay.
And I plan to continue out of my foundation funding these elections and helping states or cities or election officials, you know, develop the technology or buy the technology that they need and bring the expertise they need together to demonstrate that it can work, so that eventually reach a world where everyone can vote in elections on their phones, and then all of a sudden the logical input to the politician is the view of the mainstream, not the view of the extremes.
So this November in West Virginia, it's mobile voting for military?
Yep. It's happening right now.
Wow.
Really interesting. Because votes are being cast as we speak, because we're voting.
And why is it that it seems as if the Republicans are more afraid of mobile voting than...
It's interesting.
So who's...
First, in fairness, the one place it's done is West Virginia, which is a pretty Republican state, and Matt Warner, Secretary of State,
is
a Republican conservative, right? So, in fairness, they're the only ones who've actually done it.
Okay.
I think there's a school of thought that says that if people voted in mass, it probably wouldn't be good
for them,
Republicans, and that's why you have all these issues on voter suppression and fraud and everything else right now. But you know who really doesn't like it? People in power, right? Because most people in power don't want to make it easier to lose power. So, like, for example, I did a meeting with a whole bunch of Senate Democratic chiefs of staff on the Hill to talk about this issue. The people who were the most hostile were the people whose bosses were the most left-wing. Because if you are super left-wing, you can win in a primary if only left-wing voters are turning out. If you're super left-wing and all the voters are turning out, you're not going to win, right? So I think at the end of the day, we're going to be opposed by the left, the right, by unions, by trade groups, by lobbyists. Anyone who benefits from the current system is not going to want us to succeed.
Very interesting. So that battle's going state by state.
Yeah, and my plan is, you know, for the next couple of years, just to develop proof of concept, show that it works, kind of fund these projects all over the country. Thanks to the decision to take my Uber fee or some of that in equity, I have enough money to do this stuff now. And
how much of your fee did you take in stock?
Took half of it in stock.
Half in stock. Can you tell us?
It was 25 grand a month, so this would have been half of that. And then the fees kind of scaled up as we started adding more
jurisdictions. And it was a few years of a project.
It was over several years, but the main reason why is we just got into the Series A when the valuation was like $50 or $60 million. Today it's $72 billion. So
on the low side.
Yeah. So it has just scaled and they're talking about an IPO next year at $120 billion.
Right.
So just look, that's a needle in the haystack. I'm never gonna have a deal like that again, let alone, you know, no matter how many other companies I invest in or work with, there's a bunch that are lucrative. Nothing's quite that lucrative. But as a result, it gave me the freedom to try new business models, take a lot of risk, create my foundation. Pursue mobile voting. We also run
the school breakfast.
Yeah, so I just really care about hunger. It's an issue that's always just been matter to me. And so we fund and run.
Why is that?
You know, it just seems like I think probably because I have a really short attention span, so the most tangible thing you can do to help somebody is
help feed them.
Yeah. And I've kind of always volunteered some kitchens and things like that, so I have some background on the issue. And there's school breakfast. A lot of studies show that the kids who don't get breakfast at home also don't get to school early enough to get the free breakfast, right? It ends up sort of not really having much of an impact. And they've tried in certain places saying, why don't we do breakfast after the bell? We'll give out in the homeroom. And anyone who wants it takes it. It gets rid of all the stigma because any kid can take it. And everyone's available. And it really, really works. So I've been funding campaigns around the country to create universal school breakfast. So we passed them now. Sheila Nix, who runs our foundation, has really done all the work on this. In 8 different states, about 3 million kids now total have been impacted by it. We're going to keep just trying to pick it off state by state, and we'll fund 4, 5, 6 states a year and just keep doing it.
You you touched on, you had an interesting experience when you were essentially, you can explain to people, you were hired to by the governor of Illinois to, basically it's lieutenant governor, but you're essentially running the state, you're the staff person running the state of Illinois.
Yeah. Okay.
And you're on the phone, and you hear what appears to be kind of pay for play, not proper. And you, I mean, you clearly are not the kind of, you clearly are not going to do anything illegal. That's obvious. But what you didn't do, which I think a lot of people may have done, was do nothing. Like, as long as I don't do anything illegal, I'm probably okay. You did something. You actually, why don't you tell people a story? You picked up the phone.
Right.
Thankfully, you did.
Yeah, thank God, because otherwise we'd be doing this interview from a jail cell. So I was a deputy governor of Illinois for 4 years. I worked for a genius sociopath named Rod Blagojevich, who in some ways is the best retail politician I've ever
seen. Which is the other thing I didn't know.
Right.
You described him as a savant, basically.
Yeah, I mean,
you said he was the best retail politician.
I've never seen anyone like him in terms of a parades, worker, black church, whatever it is. Unbelievable. Now, it's, you know, people two sides of the same coin. So he's in the top 0.00001% decile or percentage of skills in a certain area.
Yep.
And then like in the bottom 25% of pretty much everything else. Right. But the things he's good at, he's world class, remarkable, best I've ever seen at. Bill Clinton level political skills.
Yeah.
And so really tumultuous, interesting 4 years. There's a lot about Rod to like and a lot about Rod to hate. But one thing, as we all learned ultimately, is that Rod certainly believed in getting as much value as he could out of government to help his campaign and pay to play corruption. And he did a lot of that. I didn't deal with grants or contracts, so it didn't really ever cross my plate. But Rod had promised $2 million for an athletic facility in Rahm Emanuel's district. Rahm at the time was a congressman. Now he's obviously mayor of Chicago.
Yep.
And the money, I guess, wasn't dispersed. And one day I get a call from Rahm, typical Rahm. If you've ever watched Entourage, Ari, the character on Entourage, is based on Rahm's brother, Ari Emanuel, who's a legendary Hollywood agent. And Ari and Rahm, I guess, were reasonably similar. So it's, you know, fuck you, where's my money? What the fuck's wrong with you? Screaming at me, cursing at me, which is like a normal conversation with Rahm.
But I love in the book, and you got to read it, the book, you say, Rahm calls you up and says, where's my money for the thing? And you're like, what money, what thing?
Right. Yeah, I'm talking about. And so I said, like, let me get back to you, right? What's what I'm going to say? I don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
I'm on the phone with Rod that night. And I said, hey, by the way, Rahm called me, and he's really
excited. You're on the phone with the governor.
With the governor.
Yep.
And I just told him, hey, I got this call. Basically, I thought he should just be like, yeah, it's just, he was giving me some status update or whatever it was. And I would be like, yeah, it's being dispersed in a month or whatever it is, right? Something. And instead, he said, he's not getting that grant until I get my fundraiser. I said, what do you mean? He said, Ari, who's Ari Emanuel, who's the CEO of William Morris now, promised me a fundraiser. And if I give them the grant before I get the fundraiser, they'll never do the fundraiser. So you tell them I need my fundraiser first. Now, obviously, you can't link a government grant for a school
to a political fundraiser.
And so I said, can't really do that. So I got a phone with Rod. I called two people. First, I called a guy named John Wyma, who was a lobbyist who was close with both Rod and Rahm. And I thought because his whole lobbying business was solely based on Rod's kind of blessings and goodwill, it was a lot harder for him to say no than it was for me to say no. And I didn't want him to get tripped up and be told by Rod, call Rahm, because he would be the natural conduit. So John, here's what just happened, you know. And he said, okay, great, I won't do anything. And then I called our general counsel, Bill Quinlan, and said—
The general counsel for the governor.
For the governor, who's also our chief ethics officer, and said, you need to get your client under control.
His client being the governor, because he just made what I think is—
an illegal statement. And so to Quinlan's credit, he handled it. The grant was given, fundraiser never happened. But then when Rod was indicted in December of 2008, among the 24 counts was attempted extortion of Congressman Emanuel. So I ended up having to testify at both of his corruption trials about that incident.
Oh, so it was the attempt of the...
Yeah, because it never happened. Yeah.
And you were also fired by Donald Trump.
Rod was.
The governor was.
He was on The Apprentice. Yeah, I was on The Apprentice.
And so he was...
You know what's funny about Trump is that for someone who... I spent so much of my career in politics, he wasn't really that big of a player, right?
Huh.
I mean, even though he's president of the United States right now, like, you know, in Bloomberg world, it wasn't like even Mike... I remember when we were thinking of running for president in 16, I asked Mike, like, so how old do you know Trump personally? Like, I think I met him 3 times. 2 billionaires in a small island in Manhattan.
Right.
And he didn't really know. Yeah. So, but Rod, after he got arrested, went on Celebrity Apprentice. And
oh, it was after that.
Promptly got fired.
Yeah. Okay. Your TV pilot.
Yes.
What was that like, working on that?
It was fun. I mean, I love to write.
Was it here in New York or in L.A.?
It was set in Illinois. So the idea is one of the startups that we work with or have worked with is called Ease. It's like Uber for weed. So it's on-demand cannabis delivery. And kind of Seth Webb, who was running that account for us, and I were joking around that, like, the people we're disrupting, the drug cartels, can't lobby against you. They can kill you, but they can't lobby against you, right? And then I was like, well, what if they could? And so I made up this TV show, fictional show, about a campaign in Illinois to legalize cannabis recreationally with the drug cartels running the no campaign and the venture capitalists running the yes campaign. And it was really fun. I got an agent. I didn't really go anywhere, but I enjoyed writing it, you know. Happy to send people a copy of the script if they're interested. But it was a fun experience, and I'm having some current conversations with some TV networks about other projects.
We touched on internships. Yeah. Do you have internships here?
We do. Typically, during the school year, 3 or 4, and then the 5 or 6 over the summer, we pay. I don't believe in unpaid internships.
Okay.
But because of that, we get a lot of resumes. Some people are just someone that I need to hire because someone asked me to, and sometimes someone just comes in the door and they're great.
Yep.
If you go to the Tusk Strategies website, there's definitely a link on there somewhere to submit your resume. Please do, and please mention in the note that you heard about it on this podcast, because I'll make sure the people who run the project give it extra attention.
Okay, great. One last question. For the young person listening who, you know, in college, whatever, thinking about getting involved in government or politics, yeah, really campaigns, suggestions you may have? Or...
Yeah, I mean, a few things. One is, like, I've never had more fun in my life than when I worked at the Parks Department, right? I mean, now I do pretty cool too. But, like, you know, you really feel the sense of purpose that, like, especially city government more than even federal or state, and especially on the executive branch side where you're running something.
Right. Very hands-on.
Very hands-on. Like, it really matters. You see the result of your work every single day. And it was a blast, right? Now, I was lucky to work in an environment that really was fast-paced and had a lot of smart people in it. But generally speaking, you know, I get, you know, emails all the time from these sort of really smart millennials, Yale, whatever it is, today, I want to come work for you and help startups navigate politics. I'm like, you're 21. You don't know anything about politics. Oh, I had an internship on the Hill, or I was a poli-sci major. You know, I'm in the Ivy League. Cares, right? Like, go work on the Hill, go work on campaigns, go knock on doors, go
do
the press, go learn how to raise money, go do stuff, understand how government politics works, and then call me and, like, maybe we'll hire you. I don't know. But, like, you're useless to me. You can't advise others on what to do until you know how to do it yourself. And so, I don't think there's no, if you're interested in government politics and no one listening to this podcast isn't interested in government politics,
correct,
right? Go do it, right? Go work on the Hill, go work in city government, you know, whatever it is, volunteer in campaigns, knock on doors. It's a lot of fun. And if you don't like it, by the way, you'll know it's not the business for you. But if you do like it, I think it's a skill set that becomes useful in lots of different ways going forward and lots of different professions. You don't just have to then become a lobbyist or do government relations at some company. You know, you can do all kinds of things. I became a venture capitalist.
That is great advice. And if you do that, you might actually get the commissioner to dress up as a groundhog and go to the park and get buried.
Groundhog's Day, he popped up out of the ground in the costume, and
incredible.
Front page of Newsday the next day was the picture of him in the costume with the headline Flakes in the Forecast.
That's unbelievable.
So,
Bradley, this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was really fun.
I can't encourage people. The book is The Fixer. Mm-hmm. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it anywhere. It is a great book. It's a great read. And it really, you are reinventing the business as you go, and
right,
it's really incredible.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for taking the time.
Cool.
All right.
That was really fun.
That was great. He's going to stay up and pitch you if you're great.
Wow.
That was great. He is, I mean, you know, you can just tell from the interview. You can tell that's why he is redefining and recreating this business. He is very smart. He is very busy. You should see the shop they have going on. It is like Grand Central Station, wide open in the Bloomberg model. Everybody doing different things and working. Very, very impressive. And was really a lot to take in and a lot to learn. And I hope you enjoyed the interview. And I can't recommend his book, The Fixer, enough. It'll be in the show notes. You should pick it up. And just a great, great interview, and just a real pleasure to sit down with him. Now remember, you can subscribe and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts. If you are an Android user, you will be happy to know that we are now on Google Podcasts. You can also find us on Stitcher and Blueberry, really anywhere podcasts are found. You can follow us on Twitter, at The Lobbying Show. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/The Lobbying Show. And if you want more insights regarding the interviews and our show, you can sign up for our weekly email, Monday Morning Coffee at The Lobbying Show. And you can do that on our website. So have a great week and see you next Monday.